Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of the University of Missouri, Kansas City. This week we offer you one of the best of Talking History, or at least one of the most popular programs of the past year. It aired the week of December 15, 2003, on the 100th anniversary of the first manned flight in a gasoline-powered aircraft by Wilbur and Orville Wright. Fred Nielsen interviewed the Wrights' biographer, James Tobin. We take up the program with Joey Skidmore's This Week in History.
This Week in History, on December 20th, 1790, Samuel Slater's water-powered machinery for spinning and carding cotton began working for the first time in Rhode Island. Born in 1768, and later hailed as the father of the American Industrial Revolution, Slater began life in England. He worked in the textile industry, where he became a superintendent. But more importantly, he learned how to build and operate textile machinery. Slater immigrated to America, secretly, because it was against the British law for textile workers to leave England. And after arriving in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, he built the first water-powered textile mill. He later built several more cotton mills and established the town of Slatersville. Slater employed entire families, including children, to work in his mill, and he provided them with housing, stores, schools, and churches. In what became known as the Rhode Island system, he spun yarn in his factory, but in what was called putting out, he sent the yarn to be woven into cloth in workers' homes. It wouldn't be until 1815 that Francis Cabot Lowell integrated all operations for cloth production under one roof in his Boston Manufacturing Company in Waltham, and later in Lowell, Massachusetts.
Turning to items of historical interest in the news, we report on two items in the news, both of which involve claimants to being the first in flight and to being the primary location associated with those we celebrate as having been first. There are those who would have you believe that the age-old riddle of human flight was not solved 100 years ago at Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, but months, even years earlier, in Connecticut or New Zealand. Some claim that German-born Gustav Whitehead flew his airplane in Fairfield, Connecticut on August 14, 1901, while others insist that the New Zealand inventor Richard Peirce soared a distance of 50 yards nearly 9 months before the Wright brothers. And there are two states vying to claim the Wright brothers' legacy as their own, Ohio and North Carolina. Wilbur and Orville Wright may have chosen Kill Devil Hills, just outside Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, as the place to launch their plane, but the folks in Dayton, Ohio, insist that it was in their city that the Wright brothers conceived of the plan and made the necessary preparations. North Carolina initiated the fray by putting on its license plates, First in Flight. Ohio responded with the slogan, Birthplace of Aviation, only to have North Carolina inscribe on its state quarter, Pioneers in Flight. The matter is far from settled, but Bob Peterson of the Dayton Aviation Heritage Historical Park offers this assessment as a basis for compromise. In Dayton, they proved that powered flight was practical. At Kitty Hawk, they proved it was possible. This is Talking History.
Well, it started out down a dirty road. Started out all alone. And the sun went down as it crossed the hill. And the town lit up. The world got still. I'm learning to fly, but I ain't got wings. Coming down is the hardest thing. Well, the good old days.
December 17th marks the 100th anniversary of human flight. It was on that date that Wilbur and Orville Wright made their first manned flight in a gasoline-powered aircraft over the sands of Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. theirs is a fascinating story, presented this week by James Tobin in his conversation with Talking History's Fred Nielsen of the University of Nebraska at Omaha. To fly is one of humanity's oldest and grandest dreams. But in 1900, the best science held that powered flight would likely never be more than a dream. A handful of enthusiasts, including Wilbur and Orville Wright, the owners of a bicycle business in Dayton, Ohio, challenged the idea that the laws of physics must keep humans forever on the ground. Their story, and that of their competitors, is told by my guest James Tobin in his new book, To Conquer the Air, The Wright Brothers and the Great Race for Flight. James Tobin was twice nominated for the Pulitzer Prize in Journalism, and his first book, Ernie Pyle's War, received the National Book Critics Circle Award. Mr. Tobin, welcome.
Thanks very much for having me.
100 years ago, outside of a small circle of enthusiasts, it was generally assumed that powered flight was impossible, and to suggest otherwise was to invite ridicule. What were the obstacles thought to be?
Well, there's kind of a, I was thinking about this, there's kind of a two-level answer to that question. On one level, there was sort of a layman's skepticism about the possibility of flight, and that would be sort of the way you and I would feel about somebody who said that they were going to experiment with time travel today. You know, we would say, I mean, neither of us probably would be able to explain, you know, what laws of physics, or cosmology make time travel impossible. But we would have a basic sense that that person was attempting to do something that was impossible. And that was the cause of the most widespread skepticism about flight at the time. That's the way people felt about flight. Now, if you talk to serious scientists who had thought about it, they go back to Isaac Newton, really. And in the Wright brothers' day and age, the most prominent skeptic was a great mathematician and an astronomer named Simon Newcomb. And Newcomb said that it was essentially a problem of weight versus power. That, I mean, he recognized that it was possible to design wings to support the weight of a glider, because people had done that successfully. But if you add in an engine, you'd have to make the wings much bigger to support the engine's weight. And that, in turn, would require a more powerful engine. And a more powerful engine would weigh a lot more, and so on. It becomes this reductio ad absurdum. So what Newcomb said was that you would need sort of an impossibly powerful engine made of unimaginably light materials. And so this whole way of thinking about it focused on the problem of power and engines, and that was taken as sort of the gospel at the time.
And yet, despite that conventional wisdom, sometime in the late 1890s, the Wrights, especially Wilbur, it seems, were drawn to the challenge of building a flying machine. What drew them in?
Well, I think that both brothers had been fascinated by flight since they were children. But you're right that Wilbur, especially as an adult, took this on as kind of a special interest. They were fascinated by the experiments of the German glider pioneer Otto Lilienthal, who made many flights in the early and mid-1890s. And these were quite well publicized and quite distant, I mean, quite long flights in what we would call a hang glider. Lilienthal was killed in 1896 in a crash, and they were puzzled by sort of the question of why Lilienthal had succeeded so often and then ultimately had failed. Could his work be improved upon? In a deeper sense, I think that Wilbur was looking for something, some challenge that would be commensurate with his intellectual abilities. He was a gifted person intellectually, and in many ways, actually, really a genius. And yet he had never found something to really work on that was suited to his abilities and talents. And so this is a case of this unknown, isolated, remote individual choosing a problem to work on in his spare time for his own, just out of his own sense of fascination and his compulsion to try to achieve something great.
A half a century or so ago, there was a race to the moon, and a century ago, as you discuss, a race to fly. We know about the Wright brothers, but who were their competitors?
Well, the main person, the main American at the time, was another astronomer named Samuel Langley. Langley was the secretary of the Smithsonian Institution, probably the most prominent scientist in America. And he had realized that he wasn't going to make a great name for himself. I mean, a really historic name. He was already very prominent, but he really wanted to be known as, remembered as one of the great figures in the history of science. And he realized he wasn't going to do that as an astronomer at about the age of 50. And so he turned to this problem of flight in the 1880s with a good deal more at risk than, say, Wilbur Wright had, because Langley was very well known, and he knew that his reputation would be in danger. So he worked on a whole series of unmanned flying models and was quite successful with those. A steam-powered model of his flew for the first time in 1895 over the Potomac River. So Langley went on with the backing of the U.S. War Department to try and build a manned machine. He was the one getting all the publicity in the U.S. at the time. There were others working with Octave Chanute, an engineer in Chicago who was fascinated by the problem. And then the French had folks who were interested in this problem. The French really had pioneered the science of aerial navigation, as they called it, with hot air balloons. And they were interested in this problem, but nobody was too sure that a heavier-than-air solution would be possible in France. So it was really the Americans that were pushing forward with the idea of a fixed-wing aircraft.
Even between Langley and the Wrights, there were some differences in their understanding of the problem. Langley thought the most important thing was to build a powerful machine that was light enough to get off the ground. In reading your book, it seemed that the engine was almost an afterthought for the Wrights, who focused most of their attention before 1903 on how to achieve balance and stability in the air. I wonder, how important were those differences in the conception of the problem in the Wrights' success and Langley's ultimate failure?
Well, that's the heart of the whole thing, is that they conceived of the problem entirely differently. Langley sort of went at this as a classical scientific endeavor. He knew about Newton's arguments against the possibility of powered flight and those of others. And so he figured if he could defeat those arguments, he would have a successful flying machine. Wilbur Wright went at it entirely differently, starting with the successes that Otto Lilienthal had had and observing birds. Wilbur came to believe that, sort of broke it down into three parts. One was the question of wings that would provide sufficient lift. And there he thought that Lilienthal had shown, and others had shown who had flown gliders, that it was possible to create a wing that would bear a machine in the air. The second problem was a light engine. He recognized that. But he felt that the advent of the internal combustion engine was giving him the tools to have enough power at light enough weight. He wasn't too worried about that. The problem that no one had thought about, he believed, and the problem that had really killed Otto Lilienthal was the problem of balance and steering and equilibrium in the air. So that was what he focused on. And in fact, that conception of the problem, although he had no way of being sure of it at the time, turned out to be the correct one, because the great breakthroughs in achieving a workable airplane were breakthroughs in control and balance. That was what Langley spent almost no time thinking about, nor did any of the Wright's competitors.
There's another interesting difference between the Langley and the Wright brothers. Langley, the head of Smithsonian, had a team of people working for him. Between 1900 and 1903, he spent, I think you said, about $70,000 trying to build an airship. The Wrights, by contrast, had comparatively little help and spent less than $1,000.
Right. That's a wonderful part of the story. The Wrights were working with materials that they sort of had lying around in their bicycle shop or that they could buy at the lumber yard. Local merchants in Dayton supplied them with pretty much everything they needed. They did have a mechanic who worked with them closely, who knew a lot about machining and was able to help them build their engine. But Langley, went at it with the sort of blunderbuss approach, spending a great deal of money, having an entire staff working for him, hired a full-time engineer right out of Cornell. And nothing was too good for Langley. He wanted only the best of parts. Every metal piece had to be polished and perfect. And it was the aerodrome, the so-called aerodrome, as he called it, was a beautiful piece of engineering. It just didn't work. And of course, this was an enormous amount of money. $70,000 sounds like a pittance today for a big research project, but in those days it was very considerable. In fact, I think this was the largest sum that had ever been devoted to sort of a federal research and development scientific project.
And the product of all this fine workmanship ends up in the Potomac River, what, twice?
Yes, that's right. As I said, the unmanned aerodromes, 10 years or about 7 years earlier, had flown up to a mile, and this encouraged Langley to think that all he had to do was scale up those machines, build a bigger version of the same machine, put a man on board, and he would have a manned flying machine. But one thing after another didn't work out for him. It's really almost torturous to read his letters and his lab notebooks, because there's just an incredible series of disappointments and small setbacks and large. And so finally, as the Wrights are at Kitty Hawk in the fall of 1903, absolutely unknown, nobody's paying attention to them, with their first powered airplane getting ready to give it a try, Langley, under a great deal of public scrutiny, media scrutiny, is ready to try his manned version of the aerodrome in the fall of 1903. Charles Manley volunteers to be the pilot, his engineer, Langley's engineer. And they try it first in October with a lot of reporters watching, and it went straight down into the Potomac. One of the reporters said it flew like a handful of mortar. And so this got a lot of coverage, and Langley was ridiculed. He was out of money, and was determined to try it one more time before the winter really set in. And so on December 8th, 1903, closer to Washington this time, with even more people watching, they tried again and met with exactly the same fate. Langley and Manley believed that the problem had been with their catapult. They flew the thing off, or tried to fly it off the top of a houseboat, and they felt that the catapult had misfired and caused the damage and the collapse of the machine. In fact, as engineers have looked at this later, they've come to believe that that Langley's machine simply didn't have the kind of structural strength to withstand the forces of flight, and so that was the reason for its collapse. Plus the fact that Langley really had no way to steer it, no way to land safely. This was essentially a suicide mission for any pilot who tried it. Manley was this young guy, Charles Manley, was lucky to survive.
For the Wrights, the flight was a hobby that turned into a scientific quest as they got deeper into it. At some point, they realized certainly that planes would have to be something more than that. What use did they think planes would have?
Well, their thinking changed on that subject. When they began, they were primarily interested in gliding. They were fascinated, as I said, by Lilienthal's work, and they were fascinated especially by what Lilienthal and a couple of other people wrote about the experience of gliding. They thought this sounded like a marvelous sport, literally a sport. They were athletes themselves, especially Wilbur, and the sports that they liked were sports a little bit like gliding, figure skating, bicycling. And they had the idea that this might be a great sporting craze, like the bicycle craze had been. Now, as they worked on it and had great success with their glider, they realized that a powered machine was within their grasp. And, of course, that took them to a whole new level of sort of their aspiration and their conception of what this could become. And as they thought about it, they realized that probably the best market for their machine, their early machine, would be with the military units of nation states. So they tried to sell it to the U.S. They were rebuffed by the War Department and the Army. They tried to sell it abroad and had difficulty there, too. They did realize that the first widespread uses, would probably be military. And interestingly, they believed that in fact, this would be a sort of a tool to end wars because it would make better reconnaissance possible. Armies would become sort of trapped on the ground. They wouldn't be able to move because airplanes would be able to spot their every move, which seems like a very naive view of the use of the airplane to us today, knowing how incredibly destructive it became. But at the time, that was sort of state-of-the-art thinking, that perhaps this would allow countries to negotiate their differences rather than solve them in wars.
From our perspective, 100 years after the fact, the Wright brothers' flight at Kitty Hawk in December 1903 seems like a historical watershed. And one of the striking things in your book is how little attention the world paid to that event. Even the Wright's local paper didn't write it up.
Right. There, you see, it's hard to imagine now, but in fact, there were claims quite often in the newspapers about flying machines of various kinds. People knew, for instance, that a Brazilian named Alberto Santos Dumont in France had flown successfully in a lighter-than-air airship. He called it a dirigible, what we would call a dirigible. The idea of flight was very much associated with gas bags and balloons. So those kinds of claims appeared often. And then there were other claims that appeared by hobbyists and experimenters, one kind or another, who said they had invented flying machines. None of those panned out when investigated, but and that was part of the problem, is that sort of charlatans would make those kind of claims, and then when they were disproved, journalists became increasingly skeptical of any new claim. That's how the Wright brothers' story looked to a lot of reporters. It looked like just another one of these stories, and there was no more reason to believe theirs than anybody else's. That was part of the problem. The Wrights were reluctant to fly in public because they didn't have the thing perfected yet.
Well, patented.
I beg pardon?
Or patented either.
No, that's right. They were waiting for their patents to come through. They had applied for patents, and it took a long time for those to be approved. And so they were very reluctant to show it, knowing that there were others, that they had rivals who were watching them closely. You know, there were a small number of people who did know what they were up to. And one of them in particular, a fellow named Augustus Herring, was quite an unscrupulous customer, and they had good reason to fear that he might steal their designs. So through that kind of combination of privacy and public skepticism, it was really not until 1908 that, 5 years later, that they were sort of widely recognized as the pioneers that they were.
Well, Mr. Tobin, thanks so much for visiting with us.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you.
I've been visiting with James Tobin, the author of To Conquer the Air, The Wright Brothers and the Great Race for Flight.
For our site of the week, we continue on the subject of the Wright brothers by calling to your attention a museum exhibit and a virtual site where you can learn more about them. Here to fill you in is Talking History's Fiona Beatty.
The Smithsonian wants to debunk some common misconceptions about the Wright brothers 100 years after they started the aviation age in their homemade aircraft. I won't tell you what those misconceptions are, but you can find out for yourself at the Wright Brothers and the Invention of the Aerial Age, now at the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C. The exhibit showcases the original 1903 Wright Flyer, in which the brothers made their historic 12-second flight, and many other related items. It is part of a year-long celebration that includes commemorative events in Ohio and North Carolina. And if you can't make it to the Smithsonian, you won't be left out. Just go to the Library of Congress's American Memory website and find the Wilbur and Orville Wright Papers, also launched in time to mark the special event. The site includes some 50,000 digital images documenting the lives and works of the Wright brothers, correspondence, diaries, notebooks, scrapbooks, drawings, and more. You can find all of this at memory.loc.gov, keywords Wilbur and Orville Wright Papers.
And finally, for our commentary of the week, we turn from the Wright brothers to propaganda. As the media becomes more and more pervasive in daily life, one of the fastest-growing historical fields is the study of how certain nations or groups or individuals have manipulated the news for their own purposes. As Thomas Fleming reports, there are few better examples than the British and Americans during World War I. Fleming is the author of The Illusion of Victory, America in World War I.
You want propaganda? On April 16, 1917, the day Congress declared war on Germany, Major Palmer S. Pierce of the U.S. Army's General Staff testified before the Senate Finance Committee about the War Department's request for $3 billion. the Democratic Majority Leader, Senator Thomas S. Martin of Virginia, asked Pierce to explain how the Army was going to spend this stupendous sum. Pierce began listing how much it cost to build training camps, buy rifles, artillery, airplanes, then added nervously, "And we may have to have an army in France." "Good Lord," Senator Martin said, "you're not going to send soldiers over there, are you?" That comment exemplifies the almost incredible naivete that underlay the American decision to declare war on Germany. Everyone, including President Woodrow Wilson, assumed the war was as good as won, and all the Allies needed was additional money, food, and weaponry from America. The explanation for this state of mind goes back to August 4, 1914, the day a British ship, the Telconia, cut 5 undersea cables through which Germany communicated with America. Henceforth, American newsmen reporting the war from the German side had to send their dispatches through London, where British censors ruthlessly suppressed stories about German battlefield prowess. Meanwhile, the British government put together a covert propaganda machine employing almost 1,000 people with a separate department aimed at America. They deluged the United States with stories of fake British and French victories. Speakers by the hundreds toured America telling similar lies. A month after the United States declared war, British and French military missions arrived in Washington, D.C. The generals revealed for the first time that the Germans were close to winning the war. "We want men, men, men," one French general said. Both countries were eager to rush American draftees into their army's depleted ranks as fresh cannon fodder. A staggered Woodrow Wilson never completely recovered from this shock. Psychiatrists who have studied his behavior believe that the guilt he experienced when 120,000 Americans died in combat and from disease during the war had much to do with his erratic performance as a war leader and his eventual collapse with a cerebral thrombosis in 1919.
You've been listening to Thomas Fleming, the author of The Illusion of Victory, America in World War I. Fleming's commentary comes to us courtesy of the History News Network. And that brings us to the end of another week of Talking History. We invite your comments on this program or suggestions for future shows, which you can send us by email at talkinghistory@umkc.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, 64110. Talking History is a production of the Organization of American Historians. Joey Skidmore, producer. Fiona Beattie, assistant producer. To learn more about Talking History in the OAH, visit our website at oah.org. Until next week, this is your host, Brian LeBeau.